This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this Monday, following a nervous weekend for U.S. travelers abroad that has become an alarming extension of that global terror warning until the middle of this month. U.S. embassies in the Middle East and North Africa are closed, at least until the 10th of August, 19 embassies and consulates in all affected. But the larger story may be a sense that some elevated intensity in the communications between leaders of al-Qaeda, coupled with some recent prison breaks, may be linked to an attack that may be around the corner. A conversation about that, as well as a sign the situation may be easing in Pakistan regarding the war on terror. We begin a week-long look at post-traumatic stress disorder among veterans in the United States, and we'll end the hour with a conversation with a psychiatrist who has written a remarkable book about the mind's sometimes brutal battle with its own body.
I think that one of the things that's difficult sometimes about the patients that psychiatrists see is that these are patients whose vulnerability is very, very plain. And like anyone who's in a vulnerable situation, sometimes we defend ourselves.
But first, what does the extension of a global terror alert actually mean? Joining us now, Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much.
So, you know, it's almost impossible for me to evaluate this terror alert, you know, without thinking about Edward Snowden, the sort of NSA sort of data set that we really now much better understand what the U.S. is listening to when it goes about constructing these kinds of alerts and warnings. How do you see this in the post-Snowden era, for lack of a better term?
Well, there were a lot of Republicans and Democrats out yesterday talking about the threat and were asked about whether any of this tied into the revelations of the, you know, the NSA. And the NSA certainly is under a lot of fire right now. Both of them and all of them insisted that there was no grand conspiracy here to hype the threat or to justify the NSA surveillance. But you have to certainly, I think, disaggregate what the NSA is doing abroad versus what they're doing at home. Some Democrats yesterday said that the overseas threat didn't justify the widespread collection going on inside the United States. By all accounts, it seems that this threat overseas is out of the Arabian Peninsula, most likely in Yemen, and so that might speak to some of the NSA surveillance, not only phone surveillance, but also internet surveillance, you know, with the various terrorist groups communicating with each other.
Well, putting the whole NSA thing aside, we can at the very least assume that there's much greater sophistication now than there was pre-9/11, and this comparison has already been made, that what they're listening to now is at least as alarming as that. And if you couple the suspicion that they're getting a lot more information, this actually does become rather alarming.
Yes, certainly the warnings that were given yesterday and have been given over the last couple of days are certainly ominous, talking about and comparing anything to 9/11, obviously, raises people's fears. And it's hard for anyone outside to evaluate exactly what that means in terms of when they talk about chatter, whether that means the amount of discussions, the specificity of alleged plots is very difficult to assess. As I said, there seems to be near universal agreement among senior officials, members of Capitol Hill, also members of the Obama administration, that something serious is afoot. The what is frustrating, of course, is that they really have no clue where this might happen, and that's why you see such a broad swath of closures of American diplomatic outposts. They really don't have a sense of where this is going to play out.
How do the prison breaks that we've talked about over the last few weeks, particularly the one at Abu Ghraib in Iraq and the al-Qaeda suspects that were released there, how do they figure into this, and particularly in terms of triggering sleeper cells around the world with the kind of rhetoric they're listening to?
You know, it's unclear. The Interpol, the global police organization, put out an alert Saturday that asked for any assistance in trying to piece together information about these various prison breaks. There's been as many as 9 prison breaks over the last month, and to see whether any of them are related. And then the bigger question is, right, are any of these tied into this ominous threat that the State Department is talking about? Right now, it does not appear that there's a direct correlation. It will be interesting to find out whether the various prison breaks that have happened in Iraq, as you said, in Abu Ghraib, in Pakistan, in Libya, whether they are coordinated in any way. On the face of it, seems somewhat hard to imagine, since what we know about how these various groups communicate, they're relatively independent. It would be hard to coordinate mass prison breaks across many countries between groups that aren't necessarily closely aligned. But, you know, that's what we'll find out in the coming weeks.
Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, on the extension of the global terror alert that will keep at least 19 embassies and consulates closed around the world. Mark, thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Another look at the war on terror story, and a development you might have missed, has the U.S. put terrorists on the defensive in Pakistan, enough to scale down those controversial drone strikes.
I think the president has a very real timeline, and we hope it's going to be very, very soon.
That's Secretary of State John Kerry in an interview last week on Pakistani television, that the U.S. could end drone strikes in the country. Is Kerry telling the positive story in the war on terror as U.S. embassies close down around the world? Or is he trying to play domestic Pakistani politics and help elected civilian leader Nawaz Sharif? Christine Fair joins us now, professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Welcome back, Christine.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So is this a surprise what Kerry is doing here? Does it reflect the security situation, or is he trying to create a new relationship with the Pakistani leadership?
Well, I'm not really sure that either of those are what's going on here. For quite some time, I think the guy that's written the best work on this is Mark Mazzetti. You know, for some time, we haven't really been killing our terrorists. You know, in other words, organizations that mostly threaten us and our troops and our soldiers in Afghanistan. We've mostly been killing, well, Pakistani Taliban. And these are individuals who are primarily a threat to Pakistan. And so there's really a bunch of kabuki theater going on here. On the one hand, clearly the Pakistanis have to be providing some degree of support to these drone strikes, if for no other reason than they have to deconflict the airspace. What is our motivation for killing Pakistani terrorists? Now, that's a more, you know, complicated calculus. So I think what's actually going on here is that there's a layering effect of Pakistani command and control. It is in our long-term interest that Nawaz Sharif has a reasonably stable government. But the fact is he doesn't have any control over the levers of policy that we care most about.
Both countries benefit equally, at least that's how it's evolved, to the U.S. drone program?
Well, the problem is that when this program was conceived, again, Mark has done just the best work on this, it was a criteria or a condition that it would always remain absolutely clandestine, which meant that any involvement in the Pakistanis would never come to light. Now, obviously, you know, it has come to light. But we still don't know, for example, whether or not drone flights are still operating from within Pakistani territory. Are they all coming in from Afghanistan? There's like really fundamental things that neither Pakistanis nor Americans know. And that's quite frankly by design. So there would always be this plausible deniability. So the irony is, if you look at the data on fatalities, and there's actually some statistical data that back this up, as the drone strikes increase in frequency, the fatalities of Pakistani terrorism actually declined. And it's actually a pretty dramatic decline. As the drones picked up their activity in 2009, you can just see the violence. Now, Pakistan's still very, very violent. I'm not saying it's a, you know, it's a paradise for crying out loud. But the decline in violence is real. The problem is, because Pakistanis have been fed a very clear stream of propaganda, which is also, oddly enough, supported by the ISI and the Pakistan Army, they don't realize that they have benefited from the drone program. Now, this is by design, because what the ISI and the Army wants to ensure is that every nth drone strike is at a price that they can calibrate. Right. The last thing the Pakistanis want the Americans to do is walk off, put them on a list of states that sponsor terrorism. So they're using the drone program, and the degree to which they can generate anti-Americanism because of it to extract as much benefit from the relationship as possible. Americans, on the other hand, have no idea that we are using these drones to kill individuals who are not really affiliated to al-Qaeda or the Taliban, except in the loosest of sense, which technically is a violation of the authorization that allows these drone strikes to take place in the first place. So there's a lot of misinformation that's going on within both of our populations. And the irony is, because of this misinformation, there's opposition to a program whereby if there had been more transparency, there would probably be more support for the program.
Interesting. Christine Fair, professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, on comments by John Kerry, Secretary of State in Pakistan, about the possible future of the U.S. drone program. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For two generations now, we have understood that when we send people far away to fight for their country, they come home different.
You know what I did to get back to you?
No.
You know what I did? I love you, Grace!
These are girls, please.
You know how much I love you?
Changed. They carry with them a piece of the war.
When I was home after my first tour, it was worse. I'd wake up and there'd be nothing.
That they feel they must hide. But they can't.
You want to get us some cereal? I'll meet you at the checkout.
Okay. Cereal.
Those are movies, of course, and most Americans have experienced what is clinically called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, in movies like The Hurt Locker, Apocalypse Now, and Brothers. There are many others we might have chosen. But really, these films are more like a theme park ride for people who never experienced war to satisfy their curiosity about something they can perhaps never understand. The reality of PTSD sounds more like this. You can't see or hear PTSD. It doesn't have a distinctive rash or a scar. But someone who carries PTSD feels it, as the familiar world looks unfamiliar. A reasonable fear suddenly stands out as strange. The stress of encountering and suppressing uncontrollable feelings about details in the environment. A parked car. Something in the road. Having to choose a color of paint or a brand of cereal. Any of that can bring it on. It's there, and then it's gone. This week on The Takeaway, a closer look at PTSD, the human mind's terrible dance with memory, where only someone with PTSD hears the music.
When I first came back from Iraq in 2004, there was this sense of disconnection and realizing that I wasn't the same person.
Coming up, a conversation with Iraq veteran and journalist David Morris about the experience of PTSD that is a medical mystery, but part of a national narrative of war that in some way involves us all. That's coming up here on The Takeaway. Here are some disturbing numbers. There are over 2.3 million American veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. At least 20% of them have PTSD and or depression, according to a 2010 RAND Corporation study, which says that number may be seriously understating the problem. The percentage of vets with traumatic brain injury and PTSD is unprecedented in the history of warfare, according to numerous studies. Half of people with PTSD, according to the RAND study, do not get treatment. And the rates of post-traumatic stress are greater for veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan than from prior conflicts. Here's a number. In times of peace in any given year, 3.6% of the general population have PTSD from accidents, abuse, and natural disasters. Who are these veterans? And how can they help us to understand this experience of PTSD, which on some level involves us all? Former Marine David Morris, who experienced Iraq in combat and as a journalist, is the author of the upcoming book, The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder.
PTSD was originally known as post-Vietnam syndrome before the group that was advocating for its recognition got it recognized by psychiatry, and then it became post-traumatic stress disorder. But there was a lot of pushback from World War II veterans in the 60s and 70s to get Vietnam veterans recognized at all. There was not a willingness to acknowledge that war damaged people, that there was this effect that society had to deal with. It was a struggle up until PTSD wasn't, a lot of people don't know this, wasn't recognized until 1980. It has this classical history that goes back as long as the West does, but there wasn't an official attempt to recognize it until 1980.
How have the lessons from war borne on the clinical notions of PTSD in places that have nothing to do with war, other places associated with stress, domestic violence, abusive relationships of one kind or another?
Well, it's interesting because PTSD, is originally developed out of the veteran experience. And so it wasn't something originally that people were willing to acknowledge for rape victims and for victims of child abuse and natural disaster victims. The military experience was the original starting point for PTSD. And since then, the diagnosis has evolved somewhat, but it's been kind of a struggle to find a way to demilitarize certain aspects of the diagnosis and to understand how it relates to civilians and survivors of all kinds. And that's kind of what's interesting. I've interviewed a number of rape survivors, and to be able to talk to them with that common diagnosis and being able to understand PTSD as someone coming from a military background, there is sort of this community of survivors and this connection that can be developed through the diagnosis, which, you know, admittedly, the diagnosis is something that's, in a sense, artificial. It was something that's created by a committee, the diagnosis of PTSD. So it's not this absolute thing, but the ability to have that conversation that a war veteran can have with a rape survivor and say, hey, yeah, I have flashbacks too. Yeah, I struggle with being too switched on and being hypervigilant when I feel threatened. And so there, it's kind of an interesting thing, is there is this community that can develop via the diagnosis.
Well, on the other side of that, then, what's the downside of PTSD being such a broad designation of a whole variety of experiences?
Well, I mean, you have to start with the idea that PTSD is, in a certain sense, an artificial construct that was agreed upon by a committee of largely psychiatrists and researchers. And it's difficult at times to tell the difference between PTSD and other mental health disorders. So it's such a grab bag of symptoms that it becomes difficult to nail it down exactly, to diagnose it exactly.
Nevertheless, people who have this experience have a real tangible sense that something's going on with them. Do you tangibly feel the symptoms of PTSD yourself?
Yeah, and when I first came back from Iraq in 2004, there was this sense of disconnection and realizing that I wasn't the same person. Later, as I kept going back, I was in a helicopter that was shot up over Fallujah, the city of Fallujah. And then later, it became hard to fly on any airplane just because I thought it was going to crash, and had sort of panic attacks with that. And I know a lot of veterans struggle with this too, is most of the casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan have been caused through roadside bombs. So a lot of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans struggle with being able to drive and being able to deal with being on the road without being stressed out.
Including you?
I started to notice that when I drove, I just was irritable and really on guard, like my head was on a swivel. I was always trying to check my six and just being very attentive to the traffic going on around me. And, you notice one of the ways that you can die in Iraq and Afghanistan is by running over the wrong pothole where someone's put, an IED. I have this encyclopedic knowledge of all the potholes in my neighborhood. I know what they look like. I know how they, what they've changed from day to day. I drive around them. And so I think this is sort of, and this behavior kind of evolved over time. It wasn't something that I came back and immediately noticed. All the tactical habits that you develop and hone in a wartime situation, they become muscle memory.
And the stress is associated with life having gone on for the people who weren't in the war.
Yeah, and it's sort of one of the metaphors I go back to is the idea of veterans, and this is how I felt when I came back from Iraq as a reporter, was you sort of feel like Rip Van Winkle. You feel like you've been in this other realm for a long time, and you come back, and life has gone on. I mean, you understand that intellectually, but it's proceeded at its own pace, and you feel like you've stepped back. You've time traveled in some way. You come back and you feel as if you can't really communicate in the same way that you used to, and there's jokes that you don't get. You just sort of struggle with the impossibility of your survival and the fact that the world has gone on. And I think what I felt, and I went to Iraq 3 times and kind of went through the process again and again, is you come back and it's always the small things that can be upsetting, but then there's this sense, and I think this is more true with Iraq and Afghanistan wars than with World War II or the Civil War, for example, is that you come back and you're kind of a loner. I mean, you come back and you're probably one of the few soldiers in your hometown. Not that many people have that experience. And so there's this feeling of disconnection and feeling of aloneness. And it takes some time to kind of get in touch with and see those habits as being not particularly adaptive.
David Morris, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
David Morris is a former Marine, author of the upcoming book, The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. He spoke with us from San Diego. Has there been a reset in the U.S.-Iran relationship?
In international interactions, my government will try to build mutual trust between Iran and the regional and global countries. And this way, we will improve our national and regional security.
The inauguration yesterday of the newly elected President Hassan Rouhani in Iran was a chance to assure Iranians and U.S. leaders that an opportunity for real change exists now. The president may have signaled both yesterday in a speech that at the very least marks a radical step away from the rhetoric and style of former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Joining us now is Amir Paivar, bilingual business correspondent with BBC Persian Television. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
What's the most important message from the inauguration in your view?
I think the most important message can be summarized into two words. The slogans Mr. Rouhani used for his election campaign, namely wisdom and hope. He had a message of hope for Iranians that he will fix the economy, that he will fix the relations with the world outside, although he acknowledges it's a very, very difficult task. At the same time, he showed he's wise yesterday in a swearing-in ceremony where he handed in the list of his cabinet members right there and then. And this is in contrast to President Ahmadinejad, who, for example, had a delay of 3 months in handing in his bill for the budget. So this man means business, and he has been conveying that message throughout.
And the message is one for Iranians largely, but was there any reference to the U.S.-Iran relationship and particularly Iran's aggressive stance in Syria?
He diplomatically avoided naming certain countries, the U.S. or Israel, or particularly mentioning the case like Syria, but he did tell the world outside, in his own words, he said that to get a response, positive response from Iran, don't talk to Iran in language of sanctions, talk in language of respect, which basically he now, as the highest elected official of Iran, his message for the world is that he will not bend under pressure, but if you come to negotiation table with respect and mutual understanding that he's ready to engage, he's ready for business.
Does President Rouhani have the options at his disposal to deal with these foreign issues, or is he pretty much concentrated on placating and assuring the Iranian public that the economy is in good hands and that there will be at least no more sanctions that might affect the pocketbooks of individual Iranian consumers?
You're right. When it comes to the economy, he's Mr. Fixer. When it comes to foreign relations, he's Mr. Charmer. And absolutely to the point, he does not have all the power he needs to fix the relations with the world outside. The man who's got the last say in foreign policy and nuclear policy is the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. But the way we understand it is that even the Supreme Leader might be ready now, either because of sanctions, because of the pressure, or because of the crippling economy inside the country, he might be ready for some compromise. Now, whether it is tactical or strategic, how far he's ready to give concessions, that's million-dollar question, which we will understand soon, as soon as the nuclear negotiations start.
All right, Amir Paivar, bilingual business correspondent with the BBC Persian Television Service. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I will sing one song for my old Kentucky home, for my old Kentucky home, far away.
Nestled into a notch of Kentucky that's smack in between Nashville, Memphis, St. Louis, and Louisville, is a place where local music shares the stage with $5 bingo, ring toss, and where on a summer afternoon you can pay to dunk someone by throwing a ball at a target. As the smell of slow-cooked pork wafts across the grass, there's also the aroma of even slower-cooked Kentucky state politics. At the annual Fancy Farm picnic last Saturday in Fancy Farm, Kentucky, the barbecue was ready to eat, but the state politics won't be out of the oven for another year. Nevertheless, the 2014 Senate race was a popular side dish for voters, even at this 2013 picnic. Gabe Bullard, news director at public radio station WFPL in Louisville, sent a whole team to the picnic over the weekend. Gabe, welcome.
Hi.
So this is an absolutely mandatory political event in Kentucky. Tell me a little bit about it, and then we'll go through the candidates that really matter here.
Yeah, it's been going on for decades now that the candidates are showing up at this picnic to trade jabs. This isn't really a place where you're going to get a heavy policy speech. You're going to get some jokes at the opponent's expense. And if you're running for office in Kentucky, you pretty much have to show up. And this draws the local candidates for statewide office, for federal office, also draws out sometimes even heavier weights. Al Gore was at Fancy Farm in the past campaigning. So whenever there's a contest, then you're going to see some candidates at Fancy Farm.
And even though this is very much conservative Kentucky, rural Kentucky, you're going to find some Democratic candidates. Here's Allison Lundergan Grimes, who's the Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate race, pitted against Mitch McConnell. Listen.
I admit Allison Lundergan Grimes is a long name, but where else can you find a name with five vowels? Because it's such a long name, my grandmother and I decided we would do something about that. With your help, Kentucky, come January 2015, you can call me Senator.
Whoa, really warm and fuzzy audience there, Gabe.
Yeah, you can hear the folks chanting, we want Mitch, and you can also hear the folks chanting, ditch Mitch, really just all over the place. The crowds are quite lively.
And it's as though Barack Obama is running for office if you listen to incumbent Senator Mitch McConnell.
Is the Senate going to be run by a Nevada yes man for Barack Obama who believes coal makes you sick, or the guy you're looking at?
Is that guy we're looking at, so to speak, or listening to, on the defensive, Mitch McConnell, the minority leader in the Senate?
Yes, I would say so to a degree. You know, a month ago, most of the folks in Kentucky thought this was going to be a Fancy Farm, probably that most folks could sleep through. But then Allison Lundergan Grimes got in the race, and then Matt Bevin on the Republican side got into the race, challenging McConnell in the primary. And this has put McConnell in a bit of a crossfire. And his speech on Saturday was essentially defending not only his reputation in office, but also the power that he has in office as this defender of Kentucky.
Well, finally, let's listen to Matt Bevin, businessman from Louisville, who doesn't have the same sort of Southern accent as the other two candidates in the field that we've just heard, but is definitely the one putting Mitch McConnell on the defensive.
Where's Mitch? Where's Mitch? Where's Mitch? You know, the people of Kentucky have been wondering that for quite a while now.
So is the Democrat Grimes sitting pretty until the general election, but it's going to be knockdown drag out for Bevins and McConnell in the primary?
It looks to be that way. Matt Bevin is a wealthy man. He's getting a lot of support from Tea Party groups from outside the state. McConnell, of course, has a very strong fundraising apparatus, so I think we're going to see a lot of money spent in this primary. Meanwhile, Grimes can continue to tour the state and tout her message, and essentially she's running against McConnell. Meanwhile, Bevin's running a similar line of attack, same key, maybe a different melody, in saying that McConnell hasn't done enough to protect Kentucky with his power in the Senate.
All on a lovely Saturday afternoon at the Fancy Farm picnic, where barbecue and coleslaw was on display along with politics. Gabe Bullard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Gabe Bullard is Director of News and Editorial Strategy at WFPL in Louisville. So if you turned into CBS on your cable box early last evening, you did not hear this familiar snappy TikTok theme. New 60 Minutes, that's right. CBS and Time Warner cable subscribers are at war over cable fees. CBS wants to charge more for being the top-rated network and for its sports coverage, U.S. Open tennis, the NFL, etc., and its popular Showtime series, including Homeland. Time Warner doesn't want to pay and has shut off CBS in New York, Los Angeles, Dallas, elsewhere. Do not adjust your set, but maybe adjust the heads of the corporate brass keeping this dispute going. Joining us is John Lafayette, business editor for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine. Welcome, John.
How are you? Thank you.
Is this the opening salvo of really what's going to be a big war between content providers and cable operators? The tables have turned once again.
This has really been ramping up. There seems to be more of these than ever before right now in terms of disputes between cable operators and programmers, resulting in viewers not being able to watch the shows they want to watch on their cable systems.
Does CBS have real leverage here compared to Time Warner?
Generally, yeah. The programmers have a lot of leverage because people like their TV shows a lot better than they like their cable bills.
And does this have a direct impact on CBS revenue in the sense that if it goes on for any length of time, this recalculates ratings, recalculates ad revenues, that sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely. One of the analysts that follow these companies estimated that CBS loses about $400,000 a day between advertising revenue and retransmission fees. Now, that may sound like a lot, but in the grand scheme of things, that's about a penny per share per week in terms of profitability. So CBS can afford to wait this out and probably will.
And what is CBS demanding that Time Warner believes is outrageous?
Well, the bottom line is it's more money. CBS is getting somewhere between 75 cents and a dollar per sub per month, and they probably want a multiple-year contract that'll top out at about $2 per sub.
And what would that mean for actual subscribers? And we would assume that what goes for Time Warner would go for every other cable distributor as well.
Exactly. Generally speaking, the amount of money that the cable guys are paying the programmers has been going up, and that's been a contributor to rising cable bills, although there's a lot of argument about how much programming is a factor and how much the cable guys are charging. There are other things that the cable guys are charging for as well besides programming.
In terms of paying for viewers, is the timing of this significant in the sense that, I mean, I guess 60 Minutes is certainly an important broadcast, but it's mostly older viewers. So we're just getting into the NFL season, and I suspect Homeland is headed back for another season. All of that's right around the corner.
Right. This is sort of a soft period in time right now in the summertime, but once the regular season, both for football and for regular programming, starts kicking up, the pressure will get more intense on the cable operator because people will be more and more interested in the CBS programming.
So this could go on for the entire month of August?
It could. It could go on forever, but it's unlikely, I think, that somewhere between 2 and 3 weeks they'll figure out where this is going to end up.
And is there anything that the content producers can do? I mean, can Homeland go anywhere else other than Showtime? Can CBS offer its NFL programming on the NFL network for any advantage there?
Well, the advantage really is making this a choke point. If people can go get the programming elsewhere, all you have to do if you're a Time Warner customer right now is call up Time Warner, cancel your service, and get DirecTV. Boom, you got your CBS programming. If you have an antenna, you can get your CBS programming that way. So there are other options for people who want to get CBS programming, but they would involve leaving Time Warner Cable by and large.
I'm wondering if there's a call being made from CBS to Netflix regarding any of this.
I don't know about Netflix, Under the Dome, which is a popular summer program for CBS right now, is available 4 days after broadcast on Amazon Prime. So people who are missing that show can get that show that way. And for CBS, that's important because CBS still gets paid by Amazon for that programming. And that's the point that CBS is making, that they want to get paid for their programming.
And maybe that's the headline there. John Lafayette is business editor for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine. Thanks so much.
Very welcome. Thank you.
Hey, sports fans, recognize that CBS Sports theme? Who's the villain in your view here? On Facebook, check out Ross and Pete, who say the war is already over. Cut the cable. Come on, people. You're letting fat cat crap face zillionaires argue at each other at your own expense. Let me just say, Ross used a different word than argue. If you keep giving them your money, then you have zero right to complain to anyone. And Pete adds, don't have cable and don't need it. Lots of free and cheap content on the web, and I have digital broadcast TV in my area, so I get the local programs I need. What are all those CBS-owned characters going to do now? Is reporter Steve Croft going to wander over to CSI and try to get someone to make a big bang about this? Or just let Carrie Matheson and Nick Brody handle it all over at Showtime?
I have never been so sure and so wrong.
I'm sorry. What are you doing here?
Ducky does have some news, boss. It turns out Filthy McNasty had some clues stuck in those nooks and crannies.
No, stop!
What are you doing?
Tell them to call FAA.
Feds?
I doubt it.
Why?
Because it works.
Look, why is it so hard for you to keep one little secret?
I'm constitutionally incapable. That's why I was refused clearance for a very prestigious government research fellowship at a secret military super collider located beneath a fake agricultural station 12.5 miles southeast of Traverse City, Michigan.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to tell us which one of your favorite CBS-owned shows you're missing out on and how you deal with network options in an all-digital, on-demand world. Coming up, Mind and Body. A psychiatrist describes a battle going on inside some of her most challenging patients.
Sometimes our body responds to our psychic distress in a way that we wouldn't predict, and it's really impossible to tease them apart in the field of psychiatry.
Christine Montross, assistant professor of psychiatry at Brown University and author of Falling into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. She's with us next. When a therapist treats someone mentally ill, there's a tendency, completely natural tendency, to think that the doctor knows what is happening, understands how the mind is making a person behave like this.
You go to the charge nurse, you tell him day, time, the show you want to see is on, but you have to tell her before the show is scheduled to be on. There's this guy, and he's always requesting shows that are already played. Yes, no, you have to tell her before. He couldn't quite grasp the idea that the charge nurse couldn't make it be yesterday. She couldn't turn back time. Thank you, Einstein. Now, he was nuts. He was a fruitcake,
okay,
Jim.
That's it, Jeffrey.
Right.
Just as we as moviegoers can see the mind creating the act of actor Brad Pitt's apparent insanity in the film 12 Monkeys, we want psychiatrists to be able to see the mind operating behind the curtain, directing patients. But, of course, it doesn't work that way. A remarkable new book written by a practicing psychiatrist makes the case that her job is less about knowing what is going on inside someone mentally ill and more about being there with a patient in moments of pure desperation. Christine Montross is assistant professor of psychiatry at Brown University. She profiles her experiences with extreme cases, patients who repeatedly ingest knives, nails, and light bulbs, suffer bizarre seizures and hallucinations. Her book is Falling into the Fire. A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I have to say that as amazing as some of these stories are and the behaviors of some of the patients that you describe, other psychiatric memoirs come to mind, but really the way in which you are in there as a character is really quite remarkable. I would have thought that some of these cases would be so frustrating you'd almost have nothing to say about them, and yet you have so much to say.
Well, I think these are cases that really stayed with me after I saw these patients. These were the cases that kept me up at night, that really gnawed at me. And so writing about them was an opportunity for me to dive into them and explore them more deeply. And I think sometimes people feel as though doctors have all the answers from the outset, that things in medicine are clear cut. But I think my presence in the book is a way of letting people understand that there are often cases that we in medicine have to think deeply about and try to understand better, where the answers don't come so quickly and easily.
Well, your vulnerability is one of the amazing things about this book. I'm inclined to call you Amazon Brown based on the story of one patient, and you'll mention
sure,
her,
sure.
But all of the names, of course, are made up.
That's
because
right.
We don't want to violate any confidentiality. But who called you Amazon Brown and why?
So this was a patient that I called Lauren in the book. And Lauren was a sick young woman, 25 years old, who ingested, as you mentioned, any number of foreign objects. So bed springs, barbecue skewers, light bulbs. And this was a maladaptive pattern that she had developed where when she was distressed, she sought comfort in self-harm. And we hear about patients who do this in cutting themselves or burning themselves. But Lauren's pattern was to ingest things that were dangerous, then bring herself to the emergency room where doctors would have to remove them before there was some catastrophic perforation of her gut.
Doctors who were very frustrated, who were in some cases disgusted by her behavior. And yet you hung in there.
Well, I think we all hang in there, but certainly when someone harms themselves over and over and doctors attempt to provide relief and cure to patients, when those patients do things that undermine the treatment that the doctors seek to provide, it can be very frustrating.
And she called you Amazon Brown because you're quite tall and you went to Brown University. And I don't know how she found out those details about you, but you articulate just how she honed in on your own vulnerability as a therapist and as someone trying to figure out what was going on with Lauren. It's really an amazing scene, and I suspect when I say Amazon Brown, you flinch a little bit.
Well, I think that one of the things that's difficult sometimes about the patients that psychiatrists see is that these are patients whose vulnerability is very, very plain. And like anyone who's in a vulnerable situation, sometimes we defend ourselves. And Lauren was a patient who defended herself by lashing out against the very people that she was seeking care from.
And you describe that the ferocity of that lashing out is less a wisdom on the part of the individual with the mental illness, but a sign of their desperation, in fact.
I think that's right. I think of it almost as being a cornered animal, or not at all to equate patients with animals, but to say that any of us as human beings have animal instincts. And when we feel most vulnerable, we defend ourselves. And animals reach out with their claws and scratch. And I think patients or any of us, when we feel attacked, might be apt to say something that we hope would make the person who's coming at us retreat. And I think Lauren felt vulnerable when I was trying to access her pain, and so she lashed out at me by calling me a name. But, you know, one of the jobs in psychiatry is I feel like I can take it. And mm-hmm. I think that we're trained to try to understand that that's not about an insult. That's about a patient in pain.
The case history style here, of course, reminds us of really famous books like The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, books like that, which describe sort of phenomena in
yes.
the mind. In this case, though, and Lauren's case, is common to perhaps 2 million people in America each year. That's bigger than the audience for this radio program. That's just, you know, down the street.
That's right. And one of the reasons that I chose to write about the cases that I did is I think we have a tendency to hear about the mentally ill and hear about some of their symptoms and respond with repugnance, to kind of put a hand up and distance ourselves from those patients and say, oh, that's something so foreign and so alien. But in fact, these are people who are in our midst every day, and there's great suffering here. And so one of my real intents with the book was to bring a humanity to these patients who we might otherwise place on the periphery of our lives and act as if they're not really in the moment with us.
Who in this book did you get closest to? Did you think you could fathom what was going on inside their mind? Because you're obviously a very skilled and intelligent psychiatrist, but the extent to which you are left mysterious, yeah. you know, you're sort of befuddled by what's going on is amazing.
I think it's difficult to say which of the patients I felt the most close to. I think certainly there were two patients that resonated with me in very particular ways. One was the patient Eddie, who mm-hmm. had what we call body dysmorphic disorder. So he had these beliefs about his skin. He believed he had terrible disfiguring acne scars that caused people to respond to him in disgust, when in fact, if you or I would see him, we wouldn't have noticed anything unremarkable about his skin. But I saw him on an outpatient basis. So I saw him over and over again, and I really had a longitudinal view of his suffering. And when you see someone in an emergency room or in a hospital, that's a brief period of time in which they're under your care. But for him, I was able to really get to know and understand what he was going through and how this affected his day-to-day life for quite a period of time.
So much to read about in this book, Falling Into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. Just a final question. In your experience, does the mind rule over the body or does the body rule over the mind in these patient stories?
I wish I had a clear and concise answer to that question. I think that what we see in these cases is a real confluence of the two. You know, I write about people who have psychogenic seizures, so it looks like they're having neurologic seizures, but there's no neurologic cause for them. I think that's a perfect confluence of how sometimes our body responds to our psychic distress in a way that we wouldn't predict, and it's really impossible to tease them apart in the field of psychiatry.
Well, it's not impossible to experience firsthand the kinds of impressions of the mind that you've conveyed right there. Christine Montross is assistant professor of psychiatry at Brown University and author of Falling Into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
And from a cluttered mind, tomorrow on the program, we're talking about cluttered desks and workspaces and whether they have an impact on your creativity and efficiency. Your responses have been very interesting. From Morristown, New Jersey, one of you writes, my desk starts out neat in the morning, then it's messy all day while I work, and then neat at the end of the day. Boy, I wish I was like you. From Fort Pierce, Florida, it's all about perspective. The desk may seem messy to others, but it's organized in my mind. It says that I have a unique organizational system. Every time I clean it, I'm unable to easily locate anything. Boy, that's true with me. Take a photo of your desk. Send it to us on Twitter using the hashtag MyDesk. You can find a photo of my messy desk on our Facebook page at facebook.com/thetakeaway. And weigh in on anything you hear on the program. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening, especially to our new listeners today on WCMU in Michigan. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.